This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. We conclude our book week with TV and film writers. Paul Feig is an author and TV writer who's at work right now on a new series for HBO. It's about the same subject matter he's written about almost his entire career. Slightly nerdy young people who don't quite fit in, but wish they did. Feig was the creator of the short-lived but much-admired NBC sitcom Freaks and Geeks, which was set in high school, and co-creator of the Fox sitcom Undeclared, which was set in college. Fans of those shows may suspect that Paul Feig was kind of nerdy himself when he was growing up, and his memoir, now out in paperback, confirms those suspicions. It's called Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. Terry spoke with Feig last fall. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of his memoir.
There is no God. I mean, there can't be. Think about it. If there were, then things in life would have to be fair. There would be no suffering, there would be no war, there would be no poverty, and none of us would be born with last names that could make us the brunt of adolescent jokes for the entirety of our school careers. In a truly just universe, no child's last name would be Cox, Butts, or Seaman. No teenager would come from a family named the Hardens or the Balls. A young Richard Shaft wouldn't have to come home from school crying each day. An under-endowed Lisa Titwell wouldn't beg her parents to let her finish her education at an all-girls school. And an adolescent Paul Feig wouldn't have had to endure hearing the letters E and I consistently taken out of his last name and replaced with the letter A. But alas, I did.
That's Paul Feig reading the opening of his new memoir, Kick Me. Now, as you point out just a little further down into your book, that, you know, a lot of kids didn't even know what the word fag meant. So even though you were being called Paul Feig, a lot of kids had no clue what that was supposed to mean. I know when I was growing up, people used the words fag, fruit, fairy, and it always meant that a boy was a little effeminate. Beyond that, if it had any meaning, I don't think we knew about it.
No, I don't think they really did. I always think it must be something they heard from their fathers or from their older brothers. And it sounded like an insult, and people reacted like it was an insult, and so it just got hurled around. In my neighborhood, insults were used so oddly. For some reason, my father bought me this backpack for my books when I was in, like, second grade, and I would ride my bike to school. And there was these mean kids who, when I would ride by with that backpack, they would call me the N-word for some reason. And it didn't even make sense because I knew what that word meant. And it was like, because I have a backpack? And then if you wore white socks, you were a Polack. So there was some sort of school logic that nobody gave me the handbook on to figure out.
So would you do the whole sticks and stones thing, or would you, like, insult the person back?
No, I was never tough enough to insult them back. I would either try to make a joke and get them to laugh, and if that didn't work, I would just hightail it out of there, basically, to my nerdier friends who were in the same boat, and we would just do dialogue from Warner Brothers cartoons and be glad that we had no athletic ability and no desire to beat up other kids like everyone around me seemed to have.
Now, your memoir of adolescence really got me thinking about some things that I haven't thought about in a while. Like, you say you'd always liked girls ever since you were five. What does it mean to have a crush on a girl when you're five or six, when you're in first or second grade?
It's odd because you don't get the support of your peer group. I thought it was normal because I was just attracted to girls, and I would, you know, sort of tell that to one of my friends, and they'd give me this strange look of like, ooh, you like her? Why do you like her? And then cooties, the word cooties would generally come into play, which I don't know where the whole concept of cooties came from, but if somebody could have patented it, they would have made millions of dollars off of it. But you really felt alone in a weird way, because if you wanted to hang out with girls, it was looked at that you were being a sissy or you were a girl or something, and so they never really caught on to it. Of course, then in later years, they surged past me very quickly, figured it out, and then actually figured what the next step was, as opposed to myself, who just became best friend to every girl I knew and the safe friend.
Now, you describe your earliest feelings of sexual arousal, and this was in gym when you were climbing the ropes, and you kind of accidentally got turned on by it. And I'm really interested in hearing you talk about that feeling of confusion and discovery, realizing that something quite sensational was happening to you. Was your impulse to, like, talk about it at the next show and tell in class, or to keep it a big secret, or to run and tell your mother and father, you'll never guess what happened to me today?
Well, first of all, that was a very sexy rope, I just have to say.
But it was...
No, I knew something was happening that was probably a private thing. But on top of it, I had thought I sort of discovered something, you know, because I never talked about that sort of thing with anybody around me. And this was back, you know, this was in the late 60s when, well, I was going to say, I guess there wasn't a lot of sexual talk on television, although it was the sexual revolution. But still, it wasn't in the shows I was watching. There wasn't a lot of talk of orgasms on Bewitched or Gilligan's Island or any of those things. So I missed out on that. But I was so happy that I had found something that seemed to be pleasure giving that you didn't have to buy or pay for, other than at that moment I thought I had to climb ropes in gym class, which I didn't enjoy doing and wasn't particularly good at, but sure put my nose to the grindstone to try to get up that rope after that first time. It's odd. I don't my poor wife, she goes, boy, you were very honest in this book. And to me it was such there's few moments in your life where you have such an amazing discovery. I mean, there's times when you find a great restaurant you like, or you find a great book, or you discover a movie you've never seen. But to come across something that is so intense and life-changing as, for lack of a more discreet term, having your first orgasm, I just found it to be a profound experience. And once... it was almost disappointing once I found out that everybody experienced this, not particularly in gym class, but just as a species in general.
Was there a moment that you could put your finger on where you learned that you're supposed to feel that, you know, a lot of people were going to try to instill in you a sense of embarrassment and shame about this feeling?
You know what it was? My family used to, my father owned this store, and he just worked constantly, but we'd always take a week off, and it was his big thing for us to go on a vacation, like to the Caribbean. He loved that. We lived in Michigan, and we wanted to go somewhere warm. So we were in the Caribbean, and we first got there, and we turned on a radio show, and there was this Caribbean, I think we were in Jamaica or something, interview show, and it was this religious show talking about masturbation, and it was all these things about how when you masturbate, you lose like a day off your life, and all these strange things about how it was going to kill you. And I remember my father looking over my mother and giving her this look, and she turned off the radio. And it was very confusing for me because I thought either they know I'm doing this and I'm shortening my life and they just don't want to, you know, they want to get rid of me, or it was something that was not true and needed to be shut off. But it was very odd, because I think after that I really carried this thing with me of, oh my God, maybe it's right. Maybe every time you do this this event, you're shortening your life. It's worse than cigarettes, because I heard cigarettes, you know, knock it like a minute or something each one, but this was a whole day. So there was a lot of tense moments as a young man, kind of bargaining away my life, going, okay, I don't need, if I'm 80, I probably won't need that day because it'll be a Sunday. So if I die on a Saturday, that's all right. And then, of course, very quickly bargain myself down to being about 30 years old, I think. So there you go.
Paul Feig is my guest. He created the TV series Freaks and Geeks. When you created the characters for Freaks and Geeks, what traits from yourself did you give to the main characters?
I actually think there's a bit of me in each character. What you tend to do is, the way I like to work is kind of break up my personality a bit and sprinkle it around.
Well, let's look at the two main characters, the sister and the brother. Why don't you describe each of them and tell us which of those traits came directly from your life or from people that you knew?
Well, to be honest, I always describe it as Sam Weir was me back then and Lindsay Weir is me today. Because I always feel, and people will always back this up, that the teenage girls mature much quicker than teenage boys, and to the point of I feel that teenage girls are probably at about the same emotional maturity level as guys in their 30s, because it takes us so much longer to catch up to you guys. But for Sam, it was just this kid who really just is trying to get through the day with his friends and the things he likes, and he's not athletic, and he feels a bit intimidated by the tougher kids in school and the more popular kids, but he has a crush on the most beautiful girl in the school, the head cheerleader, which I did too. I ask this girl to go to the homecoming dance, the day of the homecoming dance, thinking for some reason she would be available. It was completely relieved when she wasn't, but at least I gave it a try. And then for Lindsay, it's just the character that questions things more. I was really into just kind of not accepting things as they were, as a lot of teenagers are, but I always found that teenage girls were a little less likely to accept things as they were, at least the ones I knew back then. And I just love the idea of an adolescent questioning things, questioning everything, questioning their religion, questioning what they're being taught, questioning popularity. And so for her to go over and hang with the freaks or the burnouts was something that I was doing back then, just because I found them to be more honest and more real.
My guest is Paul Feig. Here's a scene from his TV series, Freaks and Geeks. The main characters, Sam and Lindsay, are sitting around the dinner table with their mother and father. Sam is worried because his gym teacher just announced a new rule that everyone has to shower after class.
I don't want to get naked in front of other guys.
Well, who does? Do you know how many men have seen me naked in my lifetime? A lot. Do you think I'm comfortable with it? No, but I live with it.
I just don't want them to tease me.
Oh, who would tease you?
All right, look, here's what you do. You tell them you're proud of your body. That'll show them.
Sam, you have a beautiful body. Doesn't he, Harold?
Yes, I just said he had a beautiful body.
Those other boys are probably just jealous. Lindsay, tell your brother what a beautiful body he has.
Mom?
Lindsay?
What?
Your mother asked you to tell your brother that he has a beautiful body.
That is so stupid.
Lindsay, tell him.
It's not going to help him.
Lindsay, just say the words. It'll make him feel better.
Sam, you have a beautiful body. You're an Adonis, a slab of beef. If I wasn't your sister, oh my God.
Lindsay, can it?
See, sweetheart?
A scene from the TV series Freaks and Geeks. Our guest is Paul Feig.
Were there any pressures on you when you were doing Freaks and Geeks to smooth out the rough edges of any of the characters?
Oh, yeah. The head of the network at that time, I remember, had a lunch with Judd Apatow, the exec producer, and basically said, can't these kids ever win? Can't they have a victory? Like, it drove him crazy that we had one episode where Sam Weir finally goes on a date with the head cheerleader, and when they're at the restaurant, the head football player walks in, and she basically confides in Sam that she's in love with him, and ends up by saying, I love talking to you. You're just like my sister. And it just drove him crazy. He was like, he's on a date with a cheerleader, and she talks about another guy. Can't he have a successful victory? And it's like, no, he can't, because A, then what's the series? And B, that's not how life works out. If I went out with the cheerleader, a head cheerleader, and she said she loved me, well, then my whole life would have been different, and it wouldn't have occurred, because those kind of things in my world never occurred.
I want to mention that you told me right before we started taping that your father died a couple of days ago. And first of all, I want to say how sorry I am about that. And second of all, I think it must be, you're very affectionate toward your parents in the book, even though, I mean, you're making fun of the whole experience of adolescence, which includes, you know, having some laughs at how some laughs at your relationship with your parents, but you obviously are very affectionate about them in the book. And I think it must be a strange time to be having your book published and to be talking about all this, having just lost your father.
Yeah, it is odd. I mean, he's been sick with Parkinson's, but for a while, but he was not doing badly, so it was still quite a surprise. But I really wished he could have at least made it to the book coming out, because his picture's on the front of it. And I kept saying to him, you know, you're going to be not famous, but I said, you're going to be in bookstores all over the country, your picture. So, you got to get ready. And we joke about that. But it is sad. I mean, I love my parents. So many artists, and especially people who do comedy, are very down on their parents or had bad childhoods or say they did and are really at odds with their parents. And I just didn't have that experience. My parents were very supportive of me. My mom just loved the idea that I was leaning towards doing something creative. And my father, who owned this Army surplus store, desperately wanted me to take it over, but I was an only child also. And he saw the writing on the wall, and it was more important to him the ethic of you must be happy in your work than it was you have to do this because, you know, it's the family business or you can't let this go away. And so I feel that's the greatest thing both my parents gave me is an acceptance and a real love of life and a love of doing what you love to do.
You mentioned that your father is on the cover of your book, and you wish that he'd been alive to see it in bookstores. This is a great picture. I mean, if anybody ever challenges you and says, were you really a geek in high school? All you have to do is show them the cover of this book. And, you know, what other proof would anybody require? Can I ask you to describe this photograph?
Yeah, this photo is, the reason I put it on the cover of the book is this is a photo that would sit seriously in our house for years, and not one person ever looked at this and didn't laugh because first of all, it's three conflicting hairstyles. My father was completely bald. My mother had hair the size of a watermelon, and I had this sort of mock John Denver meets, I don't know, some other hair disaster. John Denver meets That Girl, I guess. And we're all posed very nicely in a nice studio setting, me with my spicy new jean jacket on that I'm sure I thought made me extra cool until I walked out of the studio and probably was immediately beaten up in it. What I love about this picture is it just shows how clueless one can be, because it's just we just look happy, and I look like, hey, everything's great, and you know, clearly things were not great outside of the house. I had great friends, but you know, it was there's that movie Welcome to the Dollhouse, which is so funny because it starts with a push-in on this family portrait, and everyone looks so happy, and to me that just kills me because, you know, there's the two worlds you live in, and if you come from a nice household, there's the happy womb-like environment that you're in there, and then you're just immediately every day spit out into the real world, and you kind of at night you reset, like you know when you wake up in the morning and you kind of wake up and you forget the problems of the past day for a little bit and you feel like it's a reset button, and the minute you walk out of the house and you get to the bus stop or you get to work or whatever, and it just starts wearing you down every day. But that's why I love pictures like this is like the reset button was hit and everyone's happy for the moment.
How do you think the adult Paul Feig is influenced by the adolescent Paul Feig? I mean, you're pretty successful now. You've had a TV series. You're directing a movie that you're editing now. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a new book. You know, you've done okay for yourself so far. In your book about adolescence, you describe being afraid of everything, even Ronald McDonald and Robin and the Seven Hoods scares you in the movies. I mean, are you still as afraid and self-conscious and inhibited as you were as an adolescent?
No, I'm not. I've actually kind of swung the other way where I'm there's not. It sounds so cavalier, but there's not a lot that scares me now. And what I find is I don't have patience for adults who get scared of things because I worked through it. It was odd. I mean, I was literally afraid of everything when I was a kid, from thunder to dogs to anything. And at some point, I just realized I wasn't able to do anything. And I think it was right around when I was about halfway through high school, I just said to myself, you can't go on this way. It's ridiculous. You're going to cut yourself out of so much life. And there was so much stuff that I wanted to do. I always got really inspired by things I would see. Like if I saw a movie, I wanted to be a movie actor and I wanted to direct a movie. If I saw a TV show, I wanted to have a TV show. If I read a book, I wanted to be an author. If I saw a play, I wanted to be Will Shakespeare. The good thing about all that was it made me do a lot of things and it forced me to have to break out of who I was, because the only way you could do those things, you couldn't just really sit in your room and do those outside of writing, but you had to get out and experience things. And so I've really come full circle on it. But that said, you know, it's really hard to divorce yourself from who you were. And I'd hate to forget that, because I love those feelings of back then. I love trying to remember what that intensity of being in love with somebody when you were a teenager, that crush where it's just you feel like there's a wrench in your chest. I just, to me, it's such pure emotion, and it's really beautiful. And even though it was tough back then, to lose that, you know, there is a sense of loss about having your emotions dulled a bit.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's been really a pleasure.
Paul Feig is the author of the memoir, Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. He created the TV series Freaks and Geeks.